have to tell a tale. You have to fill the stage with clues, with threads and motivations, the stitches of a plot. Draw a world to scale, with boulevards and avenues, with flesh and blood creations, some beautiful, some not. And give us a girl aglow with love's true flame. Give us a world aboard a love affair, and we'll exclaim, what a story, what a story, what a story. What a story, what a story, what a story. Thugs and slugs and assassins' lairs, the dark perversions of billionaires, a frantic tumble of louche and lush affairs. Brilliant people and brilliant scenes are little more than a slide of dreams without a story to magnify their ends and means.
Do we think brilliant stories, millionaires, louche and lush? Do we think that's prophetic? That without a story to magnify their dreams? That was the signature music for my show, which I have taken from a show called Magazine. You know, when it comes to stories, and whatever the medium, it works. You need a story. You need a story. This is Ina Chadwick. This is WPKN, 89.5 FM on your dial, and 89.5 streaming at WPKN.org, serving Fairfield, New Haven, Litchfield counties in Connecticut and Suffolk, as well as communities around the world. And you can hear this show again on podcast. And you can hear this show again on archive for 2 weeks. Meanwhile, I'm going to go right into my next story, which comes from a writer, playwright, pretty funny woman. I want to say local, but, you know, local does not make it less. This is Fran Dorf. And this is her story as it was recorded for Mouse Muse Productions at Two Boots in Bridgeport when it was here. And I so miss it because they had non-dairy pizza. And this is called, well, she'll tell you what it's called. Enjoy. Today's stories are mostly about family. It's not all sweetness and light. But family is family. These are the ties that bind and the ancestral stories we get to tell, whether you believe us or not. Fran Dorf.
Belle, Golda, Hannah, Miriam, Pessie, Bessie, Aga, and Frida. Wouldn't it be great if you always had a default answer you could keep in your cheek to whip out whenever you found yourself at a loss for words? For example, when cornered, one of my maternal grandmother's sisters, Great Aunt Golda, always said, "See here, I'm a sick woman." Belle, Golda, Hannah, Miriam, Pessie, Bessie, Aga, and Frida. These were the names of my grandma Belle and her seven sisters, every one of them now deceased, none having anything whatsoever to do with highfalutin girls' colleges. Only one came even close to college, Great Aunt Pessie, who, according to family lore, was her father's favorite and the lone girl to be sent to higher education, in her case, pharmacy school. Great Aunt Pessie, the nymphomaniac. Say what? I just love family lore, which interacts with the failings of human memory and random tidbits of knowledge and imagination to reduce human lives in perpetuity to memorable bits of gossip with an element of truth, or truth with an element of gossip, depending on how you look at it and who's doing the looking. Belle, Golda, Hannah, Miriam, Pessie, Bessie, Aga, and Frida. If you say these names quickly without stopping for a breath, you'll find yourself instantly connected to a long-vanished world of belching smokestacks, immigrant peddlers, chasing, killing, and plucking your own chickens for dinner, premature death in boiling tenements filled with sweating bodies. Good riddance to all that, even if we're now destroying the planet and risking global destruction. Now, I wish I could report that Grandma Bell, may she rest in peace, was a bosomy old lady with whom I forged a deep and abiding bond. I wish I could say I adored sitting at her knee, listening to wonderful tales about the good old days of the old country. I cannot, though she did give me certain advice. "Listen here, girlie," she'd say. "My mother died of a strangulated hernia. That's what happens to women who give birth to 15 children. Author Epiphany. Come to think of it, my talent for naked survival may have come directly from Grandma Bell. My mother and father were just depressed, but Grandma Bell survived the hardships of her life with a certain enthusiastic vengeance. Grandma was one tough cookie. That's me, too. I guess I bounce, though for quite a while after my son Michael died, I hit the dirt and stayed there like an old lox. But unlike Grandma Bell, I like to think I've managed to retain, well, regain my sense of humor. Now, altogether, there were 11 children in Grandma Bell's family, including three brothers, Harry, Jack, and Marvin. The boys didn't count for much in Grandma's world. Her seven sisters were her life. She hated each one of them, but if God forbid you agreed they were scum, she'd take your head off and tuck it under her ample armpit. One of my all-time favorite family photographs is a little picture of Grandma Bell and her seven sisters circa 1935 walking along the legendary boardwalk in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Long before gambling came in, if you lived in Philadelphia, as we did, you went to the shore for the summer or the weekend to wear your mink coat, to see and be seen, bask in the sun on the wide beaches, stroll a rider wicker pushcart on the boards past stately old hotels with names like the Ambassador and the Ritz. Linked arm in arm, the seven sepia sisters in the photograph are marching toward us like a battalion, skirts at mid-calf, each wearing a variation of a bowed, ruffled polka dot dress. Big dots, small dots, dark dots on white, white on dark. Dots must have been in that year. My late grandmother, Belle Shapiro Birnbaum, who lived with us from the beginning, is the woman on the end, the biggest one in a pack of very large polka-dotted women. Shapiro women were huge. The seven of them stretched halfway across the boardwalk. Grandma Bell couldn't have been more than 35, but she was so heavy, her bosom so vast, her hips so wide that it looked like she might topple over in stick legs and bad feet in orthopedic shoes. Black, of course. Now, the fact that we live with Grandma was only one of the things that made our house a little bit different from all the others on the block. Oh, sure, looking back, we had some real eccentrics on Floral Park Lane. Dana's mom, Aunt Tweety, who screamed all the time and swathed her furniture in plastic. And Lisa and Janice's mom, Aunt Betty, skinny and tough as a gangster's moll, cigarette perpetually dangling from the side of her mouth. And Uncle Dick, who every evening sat alone on a little chair in the middle of his garage amidst the tools and the hula hoops and the bicycles, with the door wide open and the lights blazing like a beacon in the night, as if he were hoping to be rescued. Like I said, plenty of eccentrics. We were, however, unquestionably the only house in the neighborhood in which an eccentric 12-year-old was concocting a detailed plan, complete with maps and flowcharts and graphs and timelines, to rob the Rockefeller estate and give all the money to the poor. That 12-year-old was my older brother, Ira. Now, my parents didn't think this weird preoccupation of his was to be discouraged. Maybe the idea of giving all the money to the poor appealed to their socialist politics. Whatever. I was only 10 at the time, but when this went on for many, many months, I began to wonder what was up. On the outside, we were another split-level post-World War II house on a quarter-acre plot. Inside, we were up to our ears in felonious conspiracy. Now, each and every day of her life, Grandma Bell talked on the phone to her sisters. I'd come home from, say, 7th grade, all 5'8" of me, weighing in about 100 pounds, towering over everyone, chest as flat as a Frisbee, until 8th grade when I suddenly popped out a pair of D's, not as big as Grandma's, but to me, watermelons. I'd be beside myself because my algebra teacher, Miss Rawson, had called me Big Franny, there being in those days no recourse for a teacher's for a teacher's personal stupid remarks, or because my history teacher, Mr. Starno, had made a sexual comment that deeply upset me but that I didn't know should have been allowed, or because my English teacher, Mr. Levitt, had eyed me strangely and said, "Ira's little sister, eh?" And Grandma Bell would be sitting at the linoleum table in the kitchen talking on the phone to one of her sisters. In the psychology trade, we call my grandmother's relationship with her sisters enmeshment. These seven sisters were enmeshed to the point of asphyxiation. And what was Grandma Bell doing? Well, for the most part, to Golda, she talked about Hannah, Miriam, Bessie, Pessy, Aga, and Frida. To Miriam, she talked about Golda, Hannah, Bessie, Pessy, Aga, and Frida, and so on. Now, Pessy had died fairly young, but being dead didn't give you a pass on being talked about. Luckily, though, my grandmother didn't ever talk to Pessy. The real nuts were on my father's side.
I love that. I came from a similar... These are first generation or immigrants, and they all looked like that in my mind. I think Fran may have posted a picture or shown me a picture, or maybe it's a picture from my own childhood. My mother was one of five sisters, and my mother's youngest sister used to say, "I love my sister Hannah, but I do not like her." And, the five sisters. But they were all kind of struggling to survive in a country they didn't understand. But I love that chutzpah, for lack of a better word, or there is no better word sometimes than the Yiddish, of "look here, I'm a sick woman." Because if we all got to say that and we said to somebody, "look here, I'm a sick woman," they would deck us in this day and age. You're supposed to keep that kind of stuff to yourself. I am going to play... something of my own story that I've never aired it. I actually told it on stage. And it has a little bit of a tragic ending, but the ending is not in the story. When you hear it, you will understand that something was clearly wrong, and it wasn't just negativity. It's about me and my sister. And give us a listen. It'll make you laugh. It didn't make me laugh. And it doesn't always make me laugh. But it's pretty funny when you think about it. Here we go. Here we go.
I have an older sister. We used to be called, she called us Elfin and Klutzen. She was 5'6" by the time she was in sixth grade. There's a photograph of us visiting with Santa. I am getting Wonderland, and I'm this big. She's almost four. She's 4 years older than me, and she's this big, and she's getting modern sewing, and she looks completely miserable, and I look dazed, like I landed from another planet, happy as could be, because I was always happy as could be. Dark as a poet, but happy as could be in the real world. Anyway, I worshipped this sister. I really worshipped her. Fourth in her class from Bronx High School of Science, came down from Cornell, where she graduated 19th in her class, to scream at me when I flunked 10th year Math 2 for the third time in a fancy prep school, saying, "Nobody in our family fails math." Tall, attractive. My mother was very invested in her. And I kind of got away with stuff because it was good not to have your parents invested in you. But as we got older, it became very clear that she wasn't the happiest person on earth. In other words, people would say, "How come you got the joie de vivre and she didn't get any?" And I would feel badly. So let's jump to 2003. We've been through a lot of stuff together. A lot of it about inheritances. A lot of it about what I thought was cheating behavior and decided not to hang out in that area with her because who needs to hold on to that? So up until 2001, when I flew Think about a silver monogrammed flask with vodka in it, a pint. Think about a Valium pill vial with 12 Valiums in it, two taken out, one for this bra side, one for the other, because if you really panic when you're flying, they work fast, but not that fast. So you got to get them down fast before you pass out. So I had perfected this flying routine over many years, enough so that my husband would never sit with me, because I became so slap happy that I would ask anyone to marry me, even the trolley with the food on it. Do you want to marry me? And he would just like say, do you have to do that? And people who I sat next to and I said, look, I'm very scared, they would be very nice to me. He didn't want to know me. So we would sit separately. And I would tell people on takeoff, which is where I had put all my phobias, I'm afraid to fly, but it's worst on takeoff. Because phobics study things. And I had studied that the worst time, the time that's the most dangerous, is the first 3 minutes when you're taking off. And I had a friend who had an airplane who took me on his little airplane. And the only thing I learned was to have one more phobia, because he asked me to look for birds in the propeller. And in those days, who the hell thought about birds in the propeller? I was checking for birds in the propeller. And I developed this way of adapting up until 2003 to those fears. I would count to 120, which is 3 minutes, open my eyes after having taken two Valiums. It was actually 2001, you know, that I could no longer carry the pint flask. I could no longer get a quick drink on the airplane. And if I drank and took the Valium too soon and we were stuck on the runway, I needed detox the next day, because I had to do it all over again. And the adrenaline fear when you are that phobic is horrifying. I hated myself. I hated flying. But I wound up having to fly a lot. 2003, my sister, who I have just kind of re-scripted our relationship, she comes to me and she says, we have never traveled together. And I'm thinking, you know, we go to restaurants together. You always think they're not going to give you the peppermill. You always say, I know we're going to go in there and they're not going to give me the peppermill. And I'm just not optimistic. Please, please, I love you so much. I've never loved anybody the way I love you. Let's go. And I had some work at that time. I had a 4-year gig in the Napa Valley for Robert Mondavi. I did a lot of promotional materials and copyright. Nice gig. I would fly out to San Francisco by myself, always sit down next to somebody, and I'd say to them, excuse me, I'm a very fearful flyer. Can you distract me? Read me anything. Read me from your magazine. Read me anything. Tell me anything for just 3 minutes, and then I won't bother you. Of course, sometimes I didn't even want to talk to them. I'd say, okay, you did your job. Thank you. I was like, end of you. So we're going to fly into San Francisco. Going to do a few things in the Napa Valley. I planned this terrific trip. We would drive down the Pacific Coast Highway to visit some cousins in San Jose, and then we would go to Los Angeles, where my very first arrogant, too handsome boyfriend and I, boyfriend lived in the Venice Canals. Even my husband likes him, but he was my boyfriend in New York, and Italian, smart, funny, rich, arrogant, and he was going to find us a place to stay. And he'd never met my sister because she was away at school. And we were kids in a prep school in Manhattan together. He was 3 years older than me. So I get this trip planned. The first thing that happens is we accidentally switched American Express cards when we were in a restaurant 3 weeks before. And I noticed it. So she thinks Continental Airlines, when they took our ticketing stuff, has the wrong information. So it becomes this hullabaloo. We settle that. We get to LaGuardia, and I tell her, she's saying, I'm so glad to be with you. I said, All I need from you is that you are very calm on takeoff and that you hold my hand. Tell me any stories. Tell me funny stories. Tell me sad stories. Tell me about the telephone book. Alphabetize. Do something that keeps me engaged. Okay, she says. So I take my two Valium and I go to the bar because it says the plane is on time and the other planes are on time too. And I go and I throw down a shot. And believe me, I could have flown the plane. That's how bad the adrenaline was at that time. And we get on the plane, we sit down, and cross check, buckle up. And my sister says, I'm not buckling this seatbelt. I said, what do you mean you're not buckling the seatbelt? There is a spring in this seat that shouldn't be here. So I said, how bad is it? You want me to switch with you? No. I want to protect you. You're my little sister. I am not going to let you sit in a seat with a spring sticking out. So I said, sister, let me try it. I don't feel a spring. Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't a brand new Raymour and Flanagan down sofa. So I put a blanket on. I said, I'll sit here. She said, I refuse to let Continental Airlines get away with this. So the stewardess comes down and says, you need to buckle up your seat, madam. We're like in seat six. She says, no, this seat is inferior. And the stewardess says, would you like to change seats? I'm sure I can. I don't want to change seats. I want you to change the seat. I want a brand new factory-built seat. And I'm thinking, stay calm. We're going to take off. Stay calm. She was so obstinate that it delayed the flight for 20 minutes. They went out and brought her a seat from another airplane. And they put that seat in there, and they locked it up. And she said, don't you understand? I'm assertive for you, because you've never learned to be assertive. Now, at this point, I just wanted to take off. And at that point, when the stewardess came around for wine, I said, have wine. So I said, sister, I'm so happy to be in the air, because by now, so many minutes have passed since this awful thing that I think, and I'm so agitated, it's just what I don't want to be. So I said, let me buy you a glass of wine. We are in the air for about 6 minutes now. That means no death. So the stewardess comes by, I say, glass of wine for my sister, glass of wine for me. The wine is $8. I give the stewardess, or whatever you call them, hostess, let's be politically correct, host, $20. And she says, I don't have the change yet. Now, we're seat six. Not first class, but seat six. Somebody said, maybe she was vying for first class. I said, no, she's downwardly mobile. That wasn't it. So my sister says, she says, I'll be back with your $4. And my sister says, no, you won't be. I know you. You're going to cheat my sister. And I'm like, oh, God, I wish I was dead. I'm trying to fly. So I wish I was dead. And I said, you can give it to me later. And my sister says, I had to sue Continental Airlines over $4 once. Now, at this point, I work up my assertion. And I say to my sister, I am 50-something years old. And I can protect myself. This woman, this stewardess, is not getting off between here and San Francisco. We are in the air now 9 minutes. And if you think she's going to run off with your $4 or my $4, let her. I will take it up. I'm willing to lose it. And she said to me, you never let anybody love you the way they should love you. Next step, we get to San Francisco. We go through a couple of things. There's never the right pepper mill in the restaurant. And finally, we are in a Ford Escort driving along the Pacific Coast Highway down south. We're going to make our first stop in San Jose. Does anyone know the Pacific Coast Highway? The rocks look like candy corn. You can drop into the ocean from just squinting. And you really have to pay attention. And I'm driving. We take turns driving, but I'm driving this time. And we're driving a Ford Escort. It doesn't go up the hill. It's not a... It's a good car, but not if you're doing, like, Italian driving. And my sister and I had not discussed the illegal shenanigans that she got caught for on my mother's will. And every time I tried to talk to her about it, for many years she didn't want to talk about it, and that's why we had a rift. Because I got screwed, and so did the government, but the government made a stink about it. I didn't. So we're driving along, and she says, I think now is a good time to talk about Ma's will. So I said, excuse me? I am driving on the Pacific Coast Highway. It's a highway you have to pay a lot of attention. No emotions. She said, well, I have no emotions about this. And I said, I realize you do. You need to zip it. So we proceed in another 6 hours to Los Angeles. And I call the old boyfriend. And he tells me he's made arrangements for us at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And his friend is like the president or whatever it is. And we are on a concierge floor for $140 a night in Marina Del Rey at the Ritz-Carlton. Now, this is an amazing price. And my sister doesn't look particularly happy about it. She said, are you sure it's good? So I said, listen, let's not really talk about this. So we get to the Ritz-Carlton, we get up to this room. It's a beautiful room. It's not double beds. It's a big queen-size bed. So I said, don't worry about it. She gets on the bed. She says, her side is crooked. What ensues then is a lot of mattress changing. And I am thinking, should I kill her? Should I kill myself? I have enough Valium. I don't have the flask, but I could do something here. And I don't know what to do. So we have mattress changes. We have all this stuff. We go to the concierge room, which has champagne and caviar and smoked salmon and all the things. And I'm so happy. And she's going to meet Paul. And Paul's soon-to-be new wife after a lot of years, who happens to look like me. His first wife was 6 feet. So anyway, he comes, braggadocio, Italian guy in, and he's very suave. And my sister is divorced and not happy. And she takes one look at him, and he takes one look at her. They've never met. And she says to him, you're using my sister. You just wanted the concierge room for free champagne and for lox and for caviar. He looks at me and he says, you got to get rid of her. You're not going to travel with her. I said, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. Story coming to an end. Next morning, he takes us out like the Hollywood tour. This is where that one lived. I used to live in the Pacific Palisades. This is Malibu Beach. And it's 10 o'clock. And he says to my sister, tell me anything you would like to see. Because I would like to get home and run. He's a marathon runner. By 4. And she says, I came here for your schedule? You are forcing my sister into a schedule? He said, I am pulling over and I'm letting you out. And I am making sure you never get back into the Ritz-Carlton again. Of course, she backed down. And the next few nights were not so pleasant. When we got in the elevator at the Ritz-Carlton to get ready to go home, she said, it's one of those elevators that takes about more than 3 minutes to go one floor. And I kept saying, you know, can we walk? In California, nobody walks. I walk to the mailbox as a stroll. So she said, let's go over all our receipts. I want to split it in half equally. So I said, I can't do this in an elevator. We'll do it on the airplane. No, I want it all fair and square right now. And I said, you can't have it that way. We get in the limo. We get in the car. We get to the airport. And when she wasn't looking, I said to the gatekeeper, can I change my seat? And I said, but you have to tell the woman who starts to argue that there was no seat there except one that was broken. And that is how I flew home with my sister in 2003, who not that long ago said to me, I can't wait to travel with you again. Didn't we have a great time? And you know what? I was old enough to say to her, I would rather you take me out in the yard and shoot me than travel with you again. Sisters, sisters, there were never such devoted sisters. Lord help the mister who comes between me and my sister. And I'm going to spare you all of my trying to hit a note that I think can only be hit if you have a little more testosterone in your body. My sister is not mentally well these days. And that was a prelude, I believe, because the cantankerousness was very hard. And I will tell you something. In her Alzheimer's state, to make it early Alzheimer's state, I miss her. I actually miss her because what kind of stories can I tell? Only to go back and back and back into our childhood. And that's something it's hard to do. Meanwhile, I was listening to treat some of my readers who like poetry, and I still am a poet. That's the dark part of me, who when I am writing something that's not going well, if it's prose, if it's a play, when I'm doing something happens, and I kind of spring into snippets of poems. One of the things I have noticed recently, as I read more and more poems, is if they're really good poems, like I'm going to play something from Billy Collins, the poet laureate. There is such an aha moment. This poem, which you'll bear with me, and if we don't get it going, I'll go to something else. This poem is called Forgetfulness. And for those of us who are, even no matter how old you are, when you have so much in your head and you go to remember an actor's name or somebody's name and you don't recollect it right away, you get this little start of, oh dear. And I remember when I was a younger poet, I used to turn to the back of the book of poetry, the magazine, to see when the poet was born, to see if they were younger than me, because I was fairly young on the scene, and I'd be a little jealous. Now, I have to look to know more about them, because I don't necessarily remember. So, let me try and cue this up, and this is Billy Collins reading Forgetfulness, I hope. Hello, Billy.
The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot. The heartbreaking conclusion.
Okay.
The entire novel.
I think I will read this poem and not have this little bot on the disc reading. That's what I'm going to do. That was a little bot, and that goes to show you need conversions. So this is called Forgetfulness. Long ago, you kissed the names. Okay, it says here. Let me go. Hello? The name of the author is the first to go, followed by identity, followed by obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read. Never even heard of. As if one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, you memorize the order of the planets. Something else is slipping away, a state flower, perhaps. The address, oh, come on, oh, dear, dear, the address
Something else is slipping away, a state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall. Well on your way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim, how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart. Isn't that lovely? Sorry I butchered it, but can't always get the best. But that was Billy Collins. I'm sure you've sat with somebody, tried to remember the name of someone's movie. She was married to the dark-haired guy. He was married to the woman. You know how that works. So, here we go with... This is also... It's relative family. This is Susan Terry, an actress, reading a piece by Leslie Chess Feller called Crosswords.
I did do a crossword puzzle, my father snapped. I didn't raise you to be stupid. At 58, suddenly I was 10 years old again. A nervous little girl caught making yet another mistake. At 90, Dad was physically frail, but his temper had not mellowed with the years. Growing up, I was afraid of him. The second of five siblings, I learned 46. Early to hide. A physician whose office was at our Brooklyn home, Dad relaxed every Sunday afternoon by doing the New York Times crossword puzzle in ink. Opening the magazine section, he would remove the puzzle page, attach it to a clipboard, and retire to his consulting room. Adjusting the extra-long green plastic visor of his favorite cap, he would take his black Waterman fountain pen from its velvet case, unscrew the top, then carefully reattach it to the other end. I used to watch, from a safe distance, as the golden nib steadily filled in the squares. Finishing a puzzle never took Dad more than 45 minutes. What's a five-letter word for bicker? What do you mean you don't know? He said the one time I ventured into his consulting room while he was doing the puzzle. Sitting behind a huge mahogany desk, he called, "Come on, bicker, you kids do it all the time." I stood there, scared, speechless. "Argue," he said, "it's obvious. How could you miss an easy one like that?" When Dad retired, my mother, a psychologist and crossword neophyte, suggested he teach her to do the puzzle. It became their weekly date. Dad was the acknowledged expert, Mom the brilliant student. Wordplay, rife with double entendres, included frequent delighted exclamations of "Yussel!" our mother's pet name for our father with whom she'd fallen in love when she was 14. When Mom died, Dad lost interest in doing the crossword puzzle. "I like doing it with your mother," he said. "What do I need it for? I've done a million of them." Soon, impaired vision made reading the clues too much of an effort. His right hand, paralyzed by a small stroke, could no longer form letters. He was a physician, incessantly diagnosing himself. New symptoms, all ominous, were his sole topic of conversation. "You're not a real doctor," he told his eldest son, a retinal surgeon. "How dare you tell me what medications I should take?" Living in my brother's home, he was either silent or sarcastic. One day, dreading my weekly visit, I wandered through a bookstore searching for something to distract him, anything to turn off the torrent of complaints. A collection of crossword puzzles caught my eye. The first was called Dubious Diagnoses. I hoped he'd find the title irresistible. I arrived having done my homework. the night before, for the first time in my life, I'd attempted to do a puzzle. After 2 hours, I'd completed only half of the upper right-hand quadrant. I was tempted to take a peek at the answers, but Dad hated a cheater. What began as an attempt to involve my father by appealing to his ego had the makings of an obsession. "Look, Dad, I need your help," I said. I'm stuck, and it's driving me nuts." White hair askew, he sat up in bed. "What's a four-letter word for outside referring to anatomy?" I said, showing him my penciled-in attempt. "Ecto," he said, then fumbled for his glasses. "Of course you're stuck," he said, squinting at the page. "You're doing it all wrong." "Really?" I said. "Come show me. There's better light in the kitchen." Pushing his walker, the old man painfully made his way out of the bedroom and across the living room. Seated at the kitchen table, he took a closer look. "This is too easy," he said. "For you," I replied, "but not for me. I'm just getting started." "Don't argue," he said. "Pay attention." Pencils were not allowed. I was to use ink, black ink. "Press hard. You're much too tentative," he said. "You always were. You have to develop confidence." As I read the clues aloud, Dad established ground rules. I was to relearn how to write the alphabet. "U doesn't have a tail. What kind of D is that? It looks like an O." And use capital letters only. Talking while he was thinking was forbidden. "I can't see the damn thing. I gotta keep it all straight in my head." And I was never to mention more than one clue at a time. "Don't jump all over the place. Focus." Enthusiasm was acceptable, but only at low volume. No shouting in my bad ear. Which one was bad? Both. The same applied to laughing. But laughter was the unexpected bonus. For once, Dad and I were on the same page. Literally. "Hooray for the torero? Olay!" we shouted in unison. "You're deafening me," he insisted with mock indignation. Loss of taste, S blank, 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 jaw, had us baffled. Suddenly, the missing six letters popped into my mind. "Schlock jaw," I said. "Brilliant," Dad replied. "Now you're getting it." Blisters from seatbelts were carbuncles. Carbuckles. Surgery for removal of a ski pole. Aspendectomy. What hell has no fury like? A woman's corns. Clue by clue, fractured ailments emerged to heal old wounds. Soon, Dad was wearing his green visor cap again, sometimes even a smile, and I, who'd spent a lifetime avoiding my father, actually looked forward to our weekly crossword puzzle date. One day after nailing, based only on first, last, and middle letters, a twist on a tricky three-word idiom that filled a full horizontal line of the puzzle, Dad allowed himself to look pleased. "This reminds me that the person I was is still here," he said quietly. "You're getting really good at it, too, just like your mother." Our weekly puzzle partnership flourished until shortly before Dad's death at age 93. On a crisp September afternoon in the kitchen of my brother's house, I placed the magnifier on what would turn out to be our final puzzle. "Wait," my father said, reaching into his pocket and extracting a familiar velvet case. "I want you to have this," he said. That day, my hand guided the waterman's golden nib, and we finished in 50 minutes. "Now we're moving," my father said. "Pretty soon we'll break 45. "No rush, Dad," I replied.
Charming. Charming. That piece actually won a contest that was run by the Westport Art Center memoir. And I kind of like Leslie Chesisfeller's depiction of her father and how much weight and authority he still held, and how scared she still was at 55, 58, did she say she was? I think I actually heard, I'm playing a cut from something called Julia and Julia, Nothing to Prove. I heard these two women. One is Julia Sweeney. He used to play Pat, the sort of gender non-specific person on Saturday Night Live. And Julia Sweeney has a partner, Julia, I think it's Sable. And they did this routine at Fairfield Theater Company. I was charmed. I may pull them down a little early because I have one other thing I do want to play. But this kind of made me, it gave me a good laugh because it's real.
Helen and I, we met at this conference and we started doing these shows in LA together at Largo. And we had this executive come to one of the shows and she met with us afterwards and said, I'm an executive at Fox Television and you guys are so great. And we want you to come in and the two of you to come in and I want you to talk about a television show with you. And we didn't really know what was going on. And so Jill and I went in. So Jill's first time to go to like a pitch meeting kind of thing.
Yeah, so I just let you do everything.
Unwisely trusted me. So we go to this meeting, and, you know, I work mostly as a writer in Hollywood, not really so much as an actress, but, you know, it was exciting, you know. And so she's told us about how great we were. That was great. And then, but I was just assuming that she was talking about a show that we would write for some, like, hot 22-year-old to sing and act in or something. It didn't. Anyway, so at the end of it, I was like, well, what are you talking about? Like, we would be in front of the camera. And she goes, yeah, like, you guys would star in it. And then I made a dumb joke. I'll just say it was stupid, you know, insecure reaction, dumb joke. I said something like, you do know that we're two women well into our 40s that you were talking about being in front of the camera, like something like that. And she said, oh, no, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, like, well, the Golden Girls were popular. And so anyway, and then she never called us again. That was the end of that. But anyway, Jill has written this great song that reminds me of this experience that we had together that she's going to sing now. It's a good anthem for people of our age who've been through it all.
I remember laying down, it was 1983, under the tree while listening to London Calling or something like that. And 23 years later, I'm here at a meeting trying to impress someone at a dying record company. I got nothing to prove. And in walks in this solemn girl that looks like she's 19 or wants to be, with her biker boots and her hair dyed black. I done that look so many years ago. She looks at me like I'm some square or I'm like her mother. Well, cute kid, I got nothing to prove. Ago. And everyone's young and beautiful and their skin is so smooth. And everyone's in the industry and I hate when they use that word. And when they tell me they're in the industry, I ask, oh, are you in steel? I got nothing to prove. Everybody now, nothing to prove.
I guess they have nothing to prove. I am going to go to one more thing. There is an end to that. If you can find out, go and look up Julia Sweeney and Julia Sable, I think it is. And you can find some of their works. Look it up online and then you can get one of the discs as we have here. I am going to play a cut of a song that comes from a show, and it's an original. It's sung by a woman named Michelle Rigotte, and it is a woman who is just getting ready to meet her lover at a hotel, but she has to leave work first, and she wants to go to the hotel because it's the only place where she feels she can get away from work. So here we go with a song called Fricking. Nope. We're going to go one more. Nope. We're not going to do that. We're going to play What a Story.
What a story.
We're going to end with this. The whole song.
What a story. What a story. You have to have a story. You have to entertain us after all. Draw a situation that we can comprehend. So show us where's the glory, and who's the one who gets to take a fall. Is there a confrontation? What happens in the end? We'll be the cue, the question, and you're the A. And when this is through, let's hope the only thing there is to say. What a story, what a story, what a story. What a story, what a story, what a story. You have to tell a tale. You have to fill the stage with clues, with threads and motivations, the stitches of a plot. Draw a world to scale, with boulevards and avenues, with flesh and blood creations, some beautiful, some not. And give us a girl, aglow with love's true flame. Give us a whirl, aboard a love affair, and we'll exclaim. What a story, what a story.
What a story. That is the signature song. This is Ina Chadwick with What a Story, the last Saturday of every month. We're trying to move along with some other organizations that are not for profit, because WPKN is not really just radio. WPKN is community involvement. So if you have a not for profit and you are in any of close to the entertainment, writers, theater groups, we can form an alliance. And after we talk and agree on our goals and we understand each other, you may be able to share resources with us and us with you. And what you can gain out of that is some exposure for your programs. This is Ina Chadwick. Actually, if you can make a donation, WPKN, listener-supported radio. We don't take a dime in advertising money. And every programmer kind of does their own thing. Obviously, you know, some play music, some do it live the way I do it. And you can call, actually go online, WPKN.org, and read about us. Donate some money. Even if it's $5. I don't usually fundraise on the air, but I love this place, and I want to have a longer show where we can do readings of plays, and even you might be part of it. Please. What a story.
To the right when the wind blows across the water.
Hi, I'm Bill Dusing.
I'm Guy Beardsley.
And I'm Richard Hill.
Join us the first and third Thursday of each month at noon for WPKN's Organic Farm Stand, bringing you news and views from the organic community.
Here are a small farm report.
The latest news on GMO labeling, pollinator protection, and organic growing techniques.
And interviews with exciting and informative authors, activists, and experts from the